then with the palm, again and again. It hurt, but Elena had no energy to resist. At last, the priest stood up, touched Wolf's shoulder, and said something. Wolf let her go and sat down. She looked around. They were all staring at her. None of them would help her, for she was not just an Egyptian. She was an Egyptian woman, and women, like camels, had to be beaten from time to time. As she met the eyes of the other passengers, they looked away, embarrassed, and turned to their newspapers, their books, and the view from the windows. No one spoke to her. She fell into her seat. Useless, impotent rage boiled within her. Almost. They had almost escaped. She put her arm around the child and pulled him close. She began to stroke his hair. After a while, he fell asleep. Chapter 27. Van Damme heard the train puff, pull, and puff again. It gathered speed and moved out of the station. Van Damme took another drink of water. The bottle was empty. He drew on his cigarette and threw away the butt. No one but a few peasants had gotten off the train. Van Damme kicked his motorcycle into life and drove away. In a few moments he was out of the little town and back on the straight, narrow road beside the canal. Soon he had left the train behind. It was noon. The sunshine was so hot it seemed tangible. Van Damme imagined that if he stuck out his arm, the heat would drag on it like a viscous liquid. The road ahead stretched into a shimmering infinity. Van Damme thought, if I were to drive straight into the canal, how cool and refreshing it would be. Somewhere along the road he had made a decision. He had set out from Cairo with no thought in his mind but to rescue Billy. But at some point he had realized that that was not his only duty. There was still the war. Van Damme was almost certain that Wolf had been too busy at midnight last night to use his radio. This morning he had given away the radio, thrown the book in the river, and burned the key to the code. It was likely that he had another radio, another copy of Rebecca, and another key to the code, and that the place they were all hidden was Asyut. If Van Damme's deception plan were to be implemented, he had to have the radio and the key, and that meant he had to let Wolf get to Asyut and retrieve his spare set. It ought to have been an agonizing decision, but somehow Van Damme had taken it with equanimity. He had to rescue Billy and Elena, yes, but after Wolf had picked up his spare radio. It would be tough on the boy, savagely tough, but the worst of it, the kidnapping, was already in the past and irreversible, and living under Nazi rule with his father in a concentration camp would also be savagely tough. Having made the decision and hardened his heart, Van Damme needed to be certain that Wolf really was on that train. And in figuring out how to check, he had thought of a way to make things a little easier for Billy and Elena at the same time. When he reached the next town, he reckoned he was at least 15 minutes ahead of the train. It was the same kind of place as the last town. Same animals, same dusty streets, same slow-moving people, same handful of brick buildings. The police station was in a central square, opposite the railway station, flanked by a large mosque and a small church. Van Damme pulled up outside and gave a series of peremptory blasts on the horn of his bike. Two Arab policemen came out of the building, a gray-haired man in a white uniform with a pistol at his belt, and a boy of 18 or 20 years who was unarmed. The older man was buttoning his shirt. Van Damme got off the bike and bawled, "Attention!" Both men stood straight and saluted. Van Damme returned the salute, then shook the older man's hand. "I'm chasing a dangerous criminal, and I need your help," he said dramatically. The man's eyes glittered. "Let's go inside." Van Damme led the way. He felt he needed to keep the initiative firmly in his own hands. He was by no means sure of his own status here, and if the policeman were to choose to be uncooperative, there would be little he could do about it. He entered the building. Through a doorway, he saw a table with a telephone. He went into that room, and the policeman followed him. Van Damme said to the older man, "Call British headquarters in Cairo." He gave him the number, and the man picked up the phone. Van Damme turned to the younger policeman. "Did you see the motorcycle?" "Yes, yes," he nodded violently. "Could you ride it?" The boy was thrilled by the idea. "I write it very well. Go out and try it." The boy looked doubtfully at his superior, who was shouting into the telephone. "Go on," Van Damme said. The boy went out. The older man held the phone out to Van Damme. "This is GHQ." Van Damme spoke into the phone. "Connect me with Captain Jakes, fast." He waited. Jakes' voice came on the line after a minute or two. "Hello, yes? This is Van Damme. I'm in the south following a hunch. There's a right panic on here since the brass heard what happened last night. The Brigadier's having kittens and Barg is running around like a fart in a colander. Where in buggeration are you, sir?" "Never mind where exactly. I won't be here much longer and I have to work alone at the moment. In order to assure the maximal support of the indigenous constabulary," he spoke like this so that the policeman would not be able to understand, "I want you to do your Dutch uncle act. Ready?" "Yes, sir." Van Damme gave the phone to the gray-haired policeman and stood back. He could guess what Jakes was saying. The policeman unconsciously stood straighter and squared his shoulders as Jakes instructed him, in no uncertain terms, to do everything Van Damme wanted and do it fast. "Yes, sir," the policeman said several times. Finally he said, "Please be assured, sir and gentlemen, that we will do all in our power." He stopped abruptly. Van Damme guessed that Jakes had hung up. The policeman glanced at Van Damme, then said, "Goodbye," to the empty wire. Van Damme went to the window and looked out. The young policeman was driving around and around the square on the motorcycle, hooting the horn and over-revving the engine. A small crowd had gathered to watch him, and a bunch of children were running behind the bike. The boy was grinning from ear to ear. "He'll do," Van Damme thought. "Listen," he said, "I'm going to get on the Ussu train when it stops here in a few minutes. I'll get off at the next station. I want your boy to drive my bike to the next station and meet me there. Do you understand?"
"Yes, sir," said the man. "The train will stop here, then?"
"Doesn't it usually?"
"The Ussu train does not stop here usually."
"Then go to the station and tell them to stop it."
"Yes, sir."
He went out at a run. Van Damme watched him cross the square. He could not hear the train yet. He had time for one more phone call. He picked up the receiver, waited for the operator, then asked for the army base in Assyut. It would be a miracle if the phone system worked properly twice in a row. It did. Assyut answered, and Van Damme asked for Captain Newman. There was a long wait while they found him. At last he came on the line. "This is Van Damme. I think I'm on the trail of your knife man."
"Jolly good show, sir," said Newman. "Anything I can do?"
"Well, now listen. We have to go very softly, for all sorts of reasons, which I'll explain to you later. I'm working entirely on my own, and to go after Wolf with a big squad of armed men would be worse than useless."
"Understood. What do you need from me?"
"I'll be arriving in Assyut in a couple of hours. I need a taxi, a large galabia, and a small boy. Will you meet me?"
"Of course, no problem. Are you coming by road?"
"I'll meet you at the city limits. How's that?"
"Fine."
Van Damme heard a distant chuff, chuff, chuff. "I have to go.
I'll be waiting for you."
Van Damme hung up. He put a 5-pound note on the table beside the telephone. A little bakshish never hurt. He went out into the square. Away to the north, he could see the approaching smoke of the train. The younger policeman drove up to him on the bike. Van Damme said, "I'm getting on the train. You drive the motorcycle to the next station and meet me there, okay?"
"Okay, okay."
He was delighted. Van Damme took out a pound note and tore it in half. The young policeman's eyes widened. Van Damme gave him half the note. "You get the other half when you meet me."
"Okay."
The train was almost in the station. Van Damme ran across the square. The older policeman met him.
"The station master is stopping the train."
Van Damme shook his hand. "Thank you. What's your name?"
"Sergeant Nispa."
"I'll tell him about you in Cairo. Goodbye." Van Damme hurried into the station. He ran south along the platform, away from the train, so that he could board it at the front end without any of the passengers seeing him through the windows. The train came in billowing smoke. The station master came along the platform to where Van Damme was standing. When the train stopped, the station master spoke to the engine driver and the footplate men. Van Damme gave all three of them bakshish and boarded the train. He found himself in an economy carriage. Wolf would surely travel first class. He began to walk along the train, picking his way over the people sitting on the floor with their boxes and crates and animals. He noticed that it was mainly women and children on the floor. The slatted wooden seats were occupied by the men with their bottles of beer and their cigarettes. The carriages were unbearably hot and smelly. Some of the women were cooking on makeshift stoves. Surely that was dangerous. Van Damme almost trod on a tiny baby crawling on the filthy floor. He had a feeling that if he had not avoided the child in the nick of time, they would have lynched him. He passed through three economy carriages. Then he was at the door to a first-class coach. He found a guard just outside, sitting on a little wooden stool, drinking tea from a glass. The guard stood up.
"Some tea, General?"
"No, thank you." Van Damme had to shout to make himself heard above the noise of the wheels beneath him. "I have to check the papers of all first-class passengers."
"All in order, all very good,"
said the guard, trying to be helpful. "How many first-class carriages are there?"
"All in order."
Van Damme bent to shout in the man's ear, "How many first-class coaches?" The guard held up two fingers. Van Damme nodded and unbent. He looked at the door. Suddenly he was not sure that he had the nerve to go through with this. He thought that Wolf had never got a good look at him. They had fought in the dark, in the alley, but he could not be absolutely sure. The gash on his cheek might have given him away, but it was almost completely covered now by his beard. Still, he should try to keep that side of his face away from Wolf. Billy was the real problem. Van Damme had to warn his son somehow to keep quiet and pretend not to recognize his father. There was no way to plan it. That was the trouble. He just had to go in there and think on his feet. He took a deep breath and opened the door. Stepping through, he glanced quickly and nervously at the first few seats and did not recognize anyone. He turned his back to the carriage as he closed the door, then turned around again. His gaze swept the rows of seats quickly. No Billy. He spoke to the passengers nearest him.
"Your papers, please, gentlemen."
"What is this, Major?"
said an Egyptian army officer, a colonel.
"Routine check, sir," Van Damme replied.
He moved slowly along the aisle, checking people's papers. By the time he was halfway down the carriage, he had studied the passengers well enough to be sure that Wolf, Elena, and Billy were not here. He felt he had to finish the pantomime of checking papers before going on to the next coach. He began to wonder whether his guesswork might have gone wrong. Perhaps they weren't on the train at all. Perhaps they weren't even heading for Asyut. Perhaps the Atlas clue had been a trick. He reached the end of the carriage and passed through the door into the space between the coaches. "If Wolf is on the train, I'll see him now," he thought. If Billy is here... He opened the door. He saw Billy immediately. He felt a pang of distress like a wound. The boy was asleep in his seat, his feet only just reaching the floor, his body slumped sideways, his hair falling over his forehead. His mouth was open, and his jaws were moving slightly. Van Damme knew, for he had seen this before, that Billy was grinding his teeth in his sleep. The woman who had her arm around him, and on whose bosom his head rested, was Elena. Van Damme had a disorienting sense of déjà vu. It reminded him of the night he had come upon Elena kissing Billy goodnight. Elena looked up. She caught Van Damme's eye. He saw her face begin to change expression, her eyes widening, her mouth coming open for a cry of surprise, and because he was prepared for something like this, he was very quick to raise a finger to his lips in a hushing sign. She understood immediately and dropped her eyes. But Wolf had caught her look, and he was turning his head to find out what she had seen. They were on Van Damme's left, and it was his left cheek which had been cut by Wolf's knife. Van Damme turned around so that his back was to the carriage. Then he spoke to the people on the side of the aisle opposite Wolf's. "Your papers, please." He had not reckoned on Billy being asleep. He had been ready to give the boy a quick sign, as he had done with Elena, and he had hoped that Billy was alert enough to mask his surprise rapidly, as Elena had done. But this was a different situation. If Billy were to wake up and see his father standing there, he would probably give the game away before he had time to collect his thoughts. Van Damme turned to Wolf and said, "Papers, please." It was the first time he had seen his enemy face to face. Wolf was a handsome bastard. His big face had strong features, a wide forehead, a hooked nose, even white teeth, a broad jaw. Only around the eyes and the mouth was there a hint of weakness, of self-indulgence, of depravity. He handed over his papers, then looked out of the window, bored. The papers identified him as Alex Wolf of Villa Les Oliviers, Garden City. The man had remarkable nerve. Van Damme said, "Where are you going, sir?"
"Asiut."
"On business?"
"To visit relations."
The voice was strong and deep, and Van Damme would not have noticed the accent if he had not been listening for it. Van Damme said,
"Are you people together?"
"That's my son and his nanny,"
Wolf said. Van Damme took Elena's papers and glanced at them. He wanted to take Wolf by the throat and shake him until his bones rattled. "That's my son and his nanny, you bastard." He gave Elena her papers.
"No need to wake the child," he said.
He looked at the priest sitting next to Wolf and took the proffered wallet.
Wolf said, "What's this about, Major?"
Van Damme looked at him again and noticed that he had a fresh scratch on his chin, a long one. Perhaps Elena had put up some resistance.
"Security, sir," Van Damme replied.
The priest said, "I'm going to Asir too."
"I see," said Van Damme. "To the convent?"
"Indeed. You've heard of it, then?"
"The place where the Holy Family stayed after their sojourn in the desert."
"Quite. Have you been there?"
"Not yet. Perhaps I'll make it this time."
"I hope so,"
said the priest.
Van Damme handed back the papers.
"Thank you."
He backed away along the aisle to the next row of seats and continued to examine papers. When he looked up, he met Wolf's eyes. Wolf was watching him expressionlessly. Van Damme wondered whether he had done anything suspicious. Next time he looked up, Wolf was staring out of the window again. What was Elena thinking? She must be wondering what I'm up to, Van Damme thought. Perhaps she can guess my intentions. It must be hard for her all the same to sit still and see me walk by without a word. At least now she knows she's not alone. What was Wolf thinking? Perhaps he was impatient, or gloating, or frightened, or eager. No, he was none of those, Van Damme realized. He was bored. He reached the end of the carriage and examined the last of the papers. He was handing them back, about to retrace his steps along the aisle, when he heard a cry that pierced his heart. "That's my dad!" He looked up. Billy was running along the aisle toward him, stumbling, swaying from side to side, bumping against the seats, his arms outstretched. Oh, God! Beyond Billy, Van Damme could see Wolf and Elena standing up, watching. Wolf with intensity, Elena with fear. Van Damme opened the door behind him, pretending to take no notice of Billy, and backed through it. Billy came flying through. Van Damme slammed the door. He took Billy in his arms. "It's all right," Van Damme said. "It's all right." Wolf would be coming to investigate.
"They took me away," Billy said. "I missed geography, and I was really, really scared."
"It's all right now."
Van Damme felt he could not leave Billy now. He would have to keep the boy and kill Wolf. He would have to abandon his deception plan and the radio and the key to the code. No, it had to be done. It had to be done. He fought down his instincts. "Listen," he said. "I'm here, and I'm watching over you, but I have to catch that man, and I don't want him to know who I am. He's the German spy I'm after, do you understand?"
"Yes, yes."
"Listen, can you pretend you made a mistake? Can you pretend I'm not your father? Can you go back to him?" Billy stared, open-mouthed. He said nothing, but his whole expression said, "No, no, no." Van Damme said, "This is a real-life tech story, Billy, and we're in it, you and I. You have to go back to that man and pretend you made a mistake. But remember, I'll be nearby, and together we'll catch the spy. Is that okay? Is it okay?" Billy said nothing. The door opened and Wolf came through.
"What's all this?"
Wolf said. Van Damme made his face bland and forced a smile.
"He seems to have woken up from a dream and mistaken me for his father. We're the same build, you and I. You did say you were his father, didn't you?
Wolf looked at Billy.
What nonsense, he said brusquely. Come back to your seat at once.
Billy stood still. Van Damme put a hand on Billy's shoulder.
Come on, young man, he said. Let's go and win the war.
The old catchphrase did the trick. Billy gave a brave grin.
I'm sorry, sir, he said. I must have been dreaming.
Van Damme felt as though his heart would break. Billy turned away and went back inside the coach.
Wolf went after him, and Van Damme followed. As they walked along the aisle, the train slowed down. Van Damme realized they were already approaching the next station, where his motorcycle would be waiting.
Billy reached his seat and sat down. Elena was staring at Van Damme uncomprehendingly. Billy touched her arm and said,
It's okay. I made a mistake. I must have been dreaming.
She looked at Billy, then at Van Damme, and a strange light came into her eyes. She seemed on the point of tears. Van Damme did not want to walk past them. He wanted to sit down, to talk, to do anything to prolong the time he spent with them. Outside the train windows, another dusty little town appeared. Van Damme yielded to temptation and paused at the carriage door.
Have a good trip, he said to Billy.
Thank you, sir.
Van Damme went out. The train pulled into the station and stopped. Van Damme got off and walked forward along the platform a little way. He stood in the shade of an awning and waited. Nobody else got off, but two or three people boarded the economy coaches. There was a whistle, and the train began to move. Van Damme's eye was fixed on the window, which he knew to be next to Billy's seat. As the window passed him, he saw Billy's face. Billy raised his hand in a little wave. Van Damme waved back, and the face was gone. Van Damme realized he was trembling all over. He watched the train recede into the hazy distance. When it was almost out of sight, he left the station. There, outside, was his motorcycle, with the young policeman from the last town sitting astride it, explaining its mysteries to a small crowd of admirers. Van Damme gave him the other half of the pound note. The young man saluted.
This ends side one of cassette 9. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.
Van Damme climbed on the motorcycle and started it. He did not know how the policeman was going to get home, and he did not care. He drove out of town on the road south. The sun had passed its zenith, but the heat was still terrific. Soon Van Damme passed the train. He would reach Assyut 30 or 40 minutes ahead of it, he calculated. Captain Newman would be there to meet him. Van Damme knew in outline what he was going to do thereafter, but the details would have to be improvised as he went along. He pulled ahead of the train which carried Billy and Elena, the only people he loved. He explained to himself again that he had done the right thing, the best thing for everyone, the best thing for Billy. But in the back of his mind, a voice said, "Cruel, cruel, cruel." Chapter 28. The train entered the station and stopped. Elena saw a sign which said in Arabic and English, Assyut. She realized with a shock that they had arrived. It had been an enormous relief to see Van Damme's kind, worried face on the train. For a while she'd been euphoric. Surely, she had felt, it was all over. She had watched his pantomime with the papers, expecting him at any moment to pull a gun, reveal his identity, or attack Wolf. Gradually, she had realized that it would not be that simple. She had been astonished and rather horrified at the icy nerve with which Van Damme had sent his own son back to Wolf, and the courage of Billy himself had seemed incredible. Her spirits had plunged farther when she saw Van Damme on the station platform, waving as the train pulled out. What game was he playing? Of course, the Rebecca code was still on his mind. He must have some scheme to rescue her and Billy, and also get the key to the code. She wished she knew how. Fortunately, Billy did not seem to be troubled by such thoughts. His father had the situation under control, and apparently the boy did not even entertain the idea that his father's schemes could fail. He had perked up, taking an interest in the countryside through which the train was passing, and had even asked Wolf where he got his knife. Elena wished she had as much faith in William Van Damme. Wolf was also in good spirits. The incident with Billy had scared him, and he had looked at Van Damme with hostility and anxiety. But he seemed reassured when Van Damme got off the train. After that, his mood had oscillated between boredom and nervous excitement. And now, arriving in Assiut, the excitement became dominant. Some kind of change had occurred in Wolf in the last 24 hours, she thought. When she first met him, he had been a very poised, suave man. His face had rarely shown any spontaneous emotion other than a faint arrogance. His features had been generally rather still. His movements had been almost languid. Now all that had gone. He fidgeted. He looked about him restlessly, and every few seconds the corner of his mouth twitched almost imperceptibly, as if he were about to grin, or perhaps to grimace, at his thoughts. The poise which had once seemed to be part of his deepest nature now turned out to be a cracked facade. She guessed this was because his fight with Van Damme had become vicious. What had begun as a deadly game had turned into a deadly battle. It was curious that Wolf, the ruthless one, was getting desperate, while Van Damme just got cooler. Elena thought, just so long as he doesn't get too damn cool. Wolf stood up and took his case from the luggage rack. Elena and Billy followed him from the train and onto the platform. This town was bigger and busier than the others they had passed through, and the station was crowded. As they stepped down from the train, they were jostled by people trying to get on. Wolf, a head higher than most of the people, looked around for the exit, spotted it, and began to carve a path through the throng. Suddenly, a dirty boy in bare feet and green striped pajamas snatched Wolf's case, shouting, "I get taxi! I get taxi!" Wolf would not let go of the case, but neither would the boy. Wolf gave a good-humored shrug, touched with embarrassment, and let the boy pull him to the gate. They showed their tickets and went out into the square. It was late afternoon, but here in the south the sun was still very hot. The square was lined with quite tall buildings, one of them called the Grand Hotel. Outside the station was a row of horse-drawn cabs. Elena looked around, half expecting a detachment of soldiery ready to arrest Wolf. There was no sign of Van Damme. Wolf told the Arab boy, "Motor taxi! I want a motor taxi!" There was one such car, an old Morris, parked a few yards behind the horse cabs. The boy led them to it. "Get in the front," Wolf told Elena. He gave the boy a coin and got into the back of the car with Billy. The driver wore dark glasses and an Arab headdress to keep the sun off. "Go south, toward the convent," Wolf told the driver in Arabic. "Okay," the driver said. Elena's heart missed a beat. She knew that voice. She stared at the driver. It was Van Damme. Van Damme drove away from the station, thinking, so far so good, except for the Arabic. It had not occurred to him that Wolf would speak to a taxi driver in Arabic. Van Damme's knowledge of the language was rudimentary, but he was able to give, and therefore to understand, directions. He could reply in monosyllables, or grunts, or even in English, for those Arabs who spoke a little English were always keen to use it, even when addressed by a European in Arabic. He would be all right as long as Wolf did not want to discuss the weather and the crops. Captain Newman had come through with everything Van Damme had asked for, including discretion. He had even loaned Van Damme his revolver, a six-shot Enfield 380, which was now in the pocket of Van Damme's trousers beneath his borrowed galabeah. While waiting for the train, Van Damme had studied Newman's map of Assiut and the surrounding area, so he had some idea of how to find the southbound road out of the city. He drove through the souk, honking his horn more or less continually in the Egyptian fashion, steering dangerously close to the great wooden wheels of the carts, nudging sheep out of the way with his fenders. From the buildings on either side, shops, cafes, and workshops spilled out into the street. The unpaved road was surfaced with dust, rubbish, and dung. Glancing into his rearview mirror, Van Damme saw that four or five children were riding his back bumper. Wolf said something, and this time Van Damme did not understand. He pretended not to have heard. Wolf repeated it. Van Damme caught the word for petrol. Wolf was pointing to a garage. Van Damme tapped the gauge on the dashboard, which showed a full tank. Kifaya, he said. Enough. Wolf seemed to accept that. Pretending to adjust his mirror, Van Damme stole a glance at Billy, wondering if he had recognized his father. Billy was staring at the back of Van Damme's head with an expression of delight. Van Damme thought, don't give the game away, for God's sake. They left the town behind and headed south on a straight desert road. On their left were the irrigated fields and groves of trees. On their right, the wall of granite cliffs, colored beige by a layer of dusty sand. The atmosphere in the car was peculiar. Van Damme could sense Elena's tension, Billy's euphoria, and Wolf's impatience. He himself was very edgy. How much of all that was getting through to Wolf? The spy needed only to take one good look at the taxi driver to realize he was the man who had inspected papers on the train. Van Damme hoped Wolf was preoccupied with thoughts of his radio. Wolf said, Rue à la Yaminyak. Van Damme knew this meant turn right. Up ahead he saw a turnoff, which seemed to lead straight to the cliff. He slowed the car and took the turn, then saw that he was headed for a pass through the hills. Van Damme was surprised. Farther along the southbound road there were some villages and the famous convent, according to Newman's map. But beyond these hills there was nothing but the western desert. If Wolf had buried the radio in the sand, he would never find it again. Surely he knew better. Van Damme hoped so, for if Wolf's plans were to collapse, so would his. The road began to climb, and the old car struggled to take the gradient. Van Damme changed down once, then again. The car made the summit in second gear. Van Damme looked out across an apparently endless desert. He wished he had a jeep. He wondered how far Wolf had to go. They had better get back to Asyut before nightfall. He could not ask Wolf questions for fear of revealing his ignorance of Arabic. The road became a track. Van Damme drove across the desert, going as fast as he dared, waiting for instructions from Wolf. Directly ahead, the sun rolled down the edge of the sky. After an hour, they passed a small flock of sheep grazing on tufty, sparse camel thorn, guarded by a man and a boy. Wolf sat up in his seat and began to look about him. Soon afterward, the road intersected a wadi. Cautiously, Van Damme let the car roll down the bank of the dried-up river. Wolf said, Rue à la Chimelak. Van Damme turned left. The going was firm. He was astonished to see groups of people, tents, and animals in the wadi. It was like a secret community. A mile farther on, they saw the explanation, a wellhead. The mouth of the well was marked by a low circular wall of mud brick. Four roughly dressed tree trunks leaned together over the hole, supporting a crude winding mechanism. Four or five men hauled water continuously, emptying the buckets into four radiating troughs around the wellhead. Camels and women crowded around the troughs. Van Damme drove close to the well. Wolf said, Andak. Van Damme stopped the car. The desert people were incurious, although it must have been rare for them to see a motor vehicle. Perhaps, Van Damme thought, their hard lives left them no time to investigate oddities. Wolf was asking questions of one of the men in rapid Arabic. There was a short exchange. The man pointed ahead. Wolf said to Van Damme, Dagri! Van Damme drove on. At last they came to a large encampment, where Wolf made Van Damme stop. There were several tents in a cluster, some penned sheep, several hobbled camels, and a couple of cooking fires. With a sudden quick movement, Wolf reached into the front of the car, switched off the engine, and pulled out the key. Without a word, he got out. Ishmael was sitting by the fire making tea. He looked up and said, "Peace be with you," as casually as if Wolf had dropped in from the tent next door.
"And with you be health and God's mercy and blessing," Wolf replied formally.
"How is thy health?"
"God bless thee. I am well, thank God."
Wolf squatted in the sand.
Ishmael handed him a cup.
"Take it." "God increase thy good fortune," Wolf said.
"And thy good fortune also."
Wolf drank the tea. It was hot, sweet, and very strong. He remembered how this drink had fortified him during his trek through the desert. Was it only 2 months ago? When Wolf had drunk, Ishmael raised his hand to his head and said,
"May it agree with thee, sir." "God grant it may agree with thee."
The formalities were done. Ishmael said,
"What of your friends?"
He nodded toward the taxi, parked in the middle of the wadi, incongruous among the tents and camels.
"They are not friends," Wolf said.
Ishmael nodded. He was incurious. For all the polite inquiries about one's health, Wolf thought, the nomads were not really interested in what city people did. Their lives were so different as to be incomprehensible.
Wolf said, "You still have my box?"
"Yes."
Ishmael would say yes, whether he had it or not. Wolf thought that was the Arab way. Ishmael made no move to fetch the suitcase. He was incapable of hurrying. Quickly meant within the next few days. Immediately meant tomorrow.
Wolf said, "I must return to the city today."
"But you will sleep in my tent."
"Alas, no."
"Then you will join us in eating."
"Twice, alas. Already the sun is low, and I must be back in the city before night falls."
Ishmael shook his head sadly, with the look of one who contemplates a hopeless case.
"You have come for your box?"
"Yes. Please fetch it, my cousin."
Ishmael spoke to a man standing behind him, who spoke to a younger man, who told the child to fetch the case. Ishmael offered Wolf a cigarette. Wolf took it out of politeness. Ishmael lit the cigarettes with a twig from the fire. Wolf wondered where the cigarettes had come from. The child brought the case and offered it to Ishmael. Ishmael pointed to Wolf. Wolf took the case and opened it. A great sense of relief flooded over him as he looked at the radio, the book, and the key to the code. On the long and tedious train journey, his euphoria had vanished. But now it came back, and he felt intoxicated with the sense of power and imminent victory. Once again he knew he was going to win the war. He closed the lid of the case. His hands were unsteady. Ishmael was looking at him through narrowed eyes.
"This is very important to you, this box."
"It's important to the world."
Ishmael said, "The sun rises and the sun sets. Sometimes it rains. We live, then we die."
He shrugged. He would never understand, Wolf thought, but others would. He stood up.
"I thank you, my cousin.
Go in safety.
May God protect thee."
Wolf turned around and walked toward the taxi. Elena saw Wolf walk away from the fire with a suitcase in his hand. "He's coming back," she said. "What now?"
"He'll want to go back to Assyut," Van Damme said, not looking at her.
"Those radios have no batteries. They have to be plugged in. He has to go somewhere where there's electricity. And that means Assyut." Billy said, "Can I come in the front?"
"No," Van Damme said. "Quiet now. Not much longer."
"I'm scared of him."
"So am I."
Elena shuddered. Wolf got into the car.
"Assyut," he said.
Van Damme held out his hand, palm upward, and Wolf dropped the key in it. Van Damme started the car and turned it around. They went along the wadi, past the well, and turned onto the road. Elena was thinking about the case Wolf held on his knees. It contained the radio, the book, and the key to the Rebecca code. How absurd it was that so much should hang on the question of who held that case in his hands, that she should have risked her life for it, that Van Damme should jeopardize his son for it. She felt very tired. The sun was low behind them now, and the smallest objects, boulders, bushes, tufts of grass, cast long shadows. Evening clouds were gathering over the hills ahead.
"Go faster," Wolf said in Arabic. "It's getting dark."
Van Damme seemed to understand, for he increased speed.
The car bounced and swayed on the unmade road. After a couple of minutes, Billy said, "I feel sick." Elena turned around to look at him. His face was pale and tense, and he was sitting bolt upright. "Go slower," she said to Van Damme. Then she repeated it in Arabic, as if she had just recalled that he did not speak English. Van Damme slowed down for a moment, but Wolf said, "Go faster." He said to Elena, "Forget about the child." Van Damme went faster. Elena looked at Billy again. He was as white as a sheet and seemed to be on the brink of tears. "You bastard," she said to Wolf.
"Stop the car," Billy said.
Wolf ignored him, and Van Damme had to pretend not to understand English. There was a low hump in the road. Breasting it at speed, the car rose a few inches into the air and came down again with a bump. Billy yelled, "Dad, stop the car! Dad!" Van Damme slammed on the brakes. Elena braced herself against the dashboard and turned her head to look at Wolf. For a split second, he was stunned with shock. His eyes went to Van Damme, then to Billy, then back to Van Damme, and she saw in his expression first incomprehension, then astonishment, then fear. She knew he was thinking about the incident on the train, and the Arab boy at the railway station, and the keffiyeh that covered the taxi driver's face. And then she saw that he knew. He had understood it all in a flash. The car was screeching to a halt, throwing the passengers forward. Wolf regained his balance. With a rapid movement, he threw his left arm around Billy and pulled the boy to him. Elena saw his hand go inside his shirt, and then he pulled out the knife. The car stopped. Van Damme looked around. At the same moment, Elena saw his hand went to the side slit of his galabiyeh and froze there as he looked into the back seat. Elena turned too. Wolf held the knife an inch from the soft skin of Billy's throat. Billy was wild-eyed with fear. Van Damme looked stricken. At the corners of Wolf's mouth, there was the hint of a mad smile. "Damn it," Wolf said. "You almost had me." They all stared at him in silence. "Take off that foolish hat," he said to Van Damme. Van Damme removed the keffiyeh. "Let me guess," said Wolf. "Major Van Damme." He seemed to be enjoying the moment. "What a good thing I took your son for insurance." "It's finished, Wolf," said Van Damme. "Half the British Army is on your trail. You can let me take you alive, or let them kill you." "I don't believe you're telling the truth," Wolf said. "You wouldn't have brought the army to look for your son. You'd be afraid those cowboys would shoot the wrong people. I don't think your superiors even know where you are." Elena felt sure Wolf was right, and she was gripped by despair. She had no idea what Wolf would do now, but she felt sure Van Damme had lost the battle. She looked at Van Damme and saw defeat in his eyes. Wolf said, "Underneath his galabiyeh, Major Van Damme is wearing a pair of khaki trousers. In one of the pockets of the trousers, or possibly in the waistband, you will find a gun. Take it out." Elena reached through the side slit of Van Damme's galabiyeh and found the gun in his pocket. She thought, how did Wolf know? And then he guessed. She took the gun out. She looked at Wolf. He could not take the gun from her without releasing Billy. And if he released Billy, even for a moment, Van Damme would do something. But Wolf had thought of that. "Break the back of the gun so that the barrel falls forward. Be careful not to pull the trigger by mistake." She fiddled with the gun. Wolf said, "You'll probably find a catch alongside the cylinder." She found the catch and opened the gun. "Take out the cartridges and drop them outside the car." She did so. "Put the gun on the floor of the car." She put it down. Wolf seemed relieved. Now, once again, the only weapon in the picture was his knife. He spoke to Van Damme. "Get out of the car." Van Damme sat motionless. "Get out," Wolf repeated. With a sudden precise movement, he nicked the lobe of Billy's ear with the knife. A drop of blood welled out. Van Damme got out of the car. Wolf said to Elena, "Get into the driving seat." She climbed over the gear stick. Van Damme had left the car door open. Wolf said,
Close the door.
Elena closed the door. Van Damme stood beside the car, staring in.
Drive, Wolf said.
The car had stalled. Elena put the gear shift into neutral and turned the key. The engine coughed and died. She hoped it would not go. She turned the key again. Again the starter failed.
Wolf said, touch the accelerator pedal as you turn the key.
She did what he said. The engine caught and roared.
Drive, Wolf said.
She pulled away.
Faster!
She changed up. Looking in the mirror, she saw Wolf put the knife away and release Billy. Behind the car, already 50 yards away, Van Damme stood on the desert road, his silhouette black against the sunset. He was quite still. Elena said, he's got no water.
No, Wolf replied.
Then Billy went berserk. Elena heard him scream, you can't leave him behind. She turned around, forgetting about the road. Billy had leaped on Wolf like an enraged wildcat, punching and scratching and somehow kicking. Yelling incoherently, his face a mask of childish rage, his body jerking convulsively like one in a fit. Wolf, who had relaxed, thinking the crisis was over, was momentarily powerless to resist. In the confined space, with Billy so close to him, he was unable to strike a proper blow, so he raised his arms to protect himself and pushed against the boy. Elena looked back to the road. While she was turning around, the car had gone off course, and now the left-hand front wheel was plowing through the sandy scrub beside the road. She struggled to turn the steering wheel, but it seemed to have a will of its own. She stamped on the brake, and the rear of the car began to slide sideways. Too late, she saw a deep rut running across the road immediately in front. The skidding car hit the rut broadside with an impact that jarred her bones. It seemed to bounce upward. Elena came up off the seat momentarily, and when she came down again, she unintentionally trod on the accelerator pedal. The car shot forward and began to skid in the other direction. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw that Wolf and Billy were being tossed about helplessly, still fighting. The car went off the road into the soft sand. It slowed abruptly, and Elena banged her forehead on the rim of the steering wheel. The whole of the car tilted sideways and seemed to be flying. She saw the desert fall away beside her and realized the car was in fact rolling. She thought it would go over and over. She fell sideways, grabbing at the wheel and the gear stick. The car did not turn turtle, but perched on its side like a coin dropped edgeways into the sand. The gear shift came off in her hand. She slumped against the door, banging her head again. The car was still. She got to her hands and knees, still holding the broken-off gear stick, and looked into the rear of the car. Wolf and Billy had fallen in a heap with Wolf on top. As she looked, Wolf moved. She had hoped he was dead. She had one knee on the car door and the other on the window. On her right, the roof of the car stood up vertically. On her left was the seat. She was looking through the gap between the top of the seat back and the roof. Wolf got to his feet. Billy seemed to be unconscious. Elena felt disoriented and helpless, kneeling on the side window of the car. Wolf, standing on the inside of the left-hand rear door, threw his weight against the floor of the car. The car rocked. He did it again. The car rocked more. On his third try, the car tilted over and fell on all four wheels with a crash. Elena was dizzy. She saw Wolf open the door and get out of the car. He stood outside, crouched, and drew his knife. She saw Van Damme approaching. She knelt on the seat, watching. She could not move until her head stopped spinning. She saw Van Damme crouch like Wolf, ready to spring, his hands raised protectively. He was red-faced and panting. He had run after the car. They circled. Wolf was limping slightly. The sun was a huge orange globe behind them. Van Damme moved forward, then seemed to hesitate curiously. Wolf lashed out with the knife, but he had been surprised by Van Damme's hesitation, and his thrust missed. Van Damme's fist lashed out. Wolf jerked back. Elena saw that Wolf's nose was bleeding. They faced each other again, like boxers in a ring. Van Damme jumped forward again. This time Wolf dodged back. Van Damme kicked out, but Wolf was out of range. Wolf jabbed with the knife. Elena saw it rip through Van Damme's trousers and draw blood. Wolf stabbed again, but Van Damme had stepped away. A dark stain appeared on his trouser leg. Elena looked at Billy. The boy lay limply on the floor of the car, his eyes closed. Elena clambered over into the back and lifted him onto the seat. She could not tell whether he was dead or alive. She touched his face. He did not stir. "Billy," she said. "Oh, Billy." She looked outside again. Van Damme was down on one knee. His left arm hung limply from a shoulder covered with blood. He held his right arm out in a defensive gesture. Wolf approached him. Elena jumped out of the car. She still had the broken-off gear stick in her hand. She saw Wolf bring back his arm, ready to slash at Van Damme once more. She rushed up behind Wolf, stumbling in the sand. Wolf struck at Van Damme. Van Damme jerked sideways, dodging the blow. Elena raised the gear stick high in the air and brought it down with all her might on the back of Wolf's head. He seemed to stand still for a moment. Elena said, "Oh, God." Then she hit him again. She hit him a third time. He fell down. She hit him again. Then she dropped the gear stick and knelt beside Van Damme. "Well done," he said weakly. "Can you stand up?" He put a hand on her shoulder and struggled to his feet. "It's not as bad as it looks," he said. "Let me see." "In a minute. Help me with this." Using his good arm, he took hold of Wolf's leg and pulled him toward the car. Elena grabbed the unconscious man's arm and heaved. When Wolf was lying beside the car, Van Damme lifted Wolf's limp arm and placed the hand on the running board, palm down. Then he lifted his foot and stamped on the elbow. Wolf's arm snapped. Elena turned white. Van Damme said, "That's to make sure he's no trouble when he comes round." He leaned into the back of the car and put a hand on Billy's chest. "Alive," he said. "Thank God." Billy's eyes opened. "It's all over," Van Damme said. Billy closed his eyes. Van Damme got into the front seat of the car. "Where's the gear stick?" he said. "It broke off. That's what I hit him with." Van Damme turned the key. The car jerked. "Good. It's still in gear," he said. He pressed the clutch and turned the key again. The engine fired. He eased out the clutch and the car moved forward. He switched off. "We're mobile," he said. "What a piece of luck." "What will we do with Wolf?" "Put him in the boot." Van Damme took another look at Billy. He was conscious now, his eyes wide open. "How are you, son?" said Van Damme. "I'm sorry," Billy said, "but I couldn't help feeling sick." Van Damme looked at Elena. "You'll have to drive," he said. There were tears in his eyes. Chapter 29. There was the sudden, terrifying roar of nearby aircraft. Rommel glanced up and saw the British bombers approaching low from behind the nearest line of hills. The troops called them party rally bombers because they flew in the perfect formation of display aircraft at the pre-war Nuremberg parades. "Take cover!" Rommel yelled. He ran to a slit trench and dived in. The noise was so loud it was like silence. Rommel lay with his eyes closed. He had a pain in his stomach. They had sent him a doctor from Germany. But Rommel knew that the only medicine he needed was victory. He had lost a lot of weight. His uniform hung loosely on him now, and his shirt collars seemed too large. His hair was receding rapidly and turning white in places. Today was September 1st, and everything had gone terribly wrong. What had seemed to be the weak point in the Allied defense line was looking more and more like an ambush. The minefields were heavy where they should have been light. The ground beneath had been quicksand, where hard going was expected. And the Alam Halfa Ridge, which should have been taken easily, was being mightily defended. Rommel's strategy was wrong. His intelligence had been wrong. His spy had been wrong. The bombers passed overhead. Rommel got out of the trench. His aides and officers emerged from cover and gathered around him again. He raised his field glasses and looked out over the desert. Scores of vehicles stood still in the sand, many of them blazing furiously. If the enemy would only charge, Rommel thought, we could fight him. but the Allies sat tight, well dug in, picking off the panzer tanks like fish in a barrel. It was no good. His forward units were 15 miles from Alexandria, but they were stuck. 15 miles, he thought. Another 15 miles and Egypt would have been mine. He looked at the officers around him. As always, their expressions reflected his own. He saw in their faces what they saw in his. It was defeat. He knew it was a nightmare, but he could not wake up. The cell was 6 feet long by 4 feet wide, and half of it was taken up by a bed. Beneath the bed was a chamber pot. The walls were of smooth gray stone. A small light bulb hung from the ceiling by a cord. In one end of the cell was a door. In the other end was a small square window, set just above eye level. Through it, he could see the bright blue sky. In his dream, he thought, I'll wake up soon. Then it will be all right. I'll wake up, and there will be a beautiful woman lying beside me on a silk sheet, and I will touch her breasts. And as he thought of this, he was filled with strong lust. And she will wake up and kiss me, and we will drink champagne. But he could not quite dream that, and the dream of the prison cell came back. Somewhere nearby, a bass drum was beating steadily. Soldiers were marching to the rhythm outside. The beat was terrifying, terrifying. Boom, 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 tramp, tramp. The drum and the soldiers and the close gray walls of the cell and that distant, tantalizing square of blue sky. And he was so frightened, so horrified, that he forced his eyes open and he woke up. He looked around him, not understanding. He was awake, wide awake, no question about it. The dream was over. Yet he was still in a prison cell. It was 6 feet long by 4 feet wide, and half of it was taken up by a bed. He raised himself from the bed and looked underneath it. There was a chamber pot. He stood upright. Then quietly and calmly, he began to bang his head against the wall. Jerusalem, 24th of September, 42. My dear Elena, today I went to the Western Wall, which is also called the Wailing Wall. I stood before it with many other Jews, and I prayed. I wrote a kavitlach and put it into a crack in the wall. May God grant my petition. This is the most beautiful place in the world, Jerusalem. Of course, I do not live well. I sleep on a mattress on the floor in a little room with 5 other men. Sometimes I get a little work, sweeping up in a workshop where one of my roommates, a young man, carries wood for the carpenters. I am very poor, like always, but now I am poor in Jerusalem, which is better than rich in Egypt. I crossed the desert in a British Army truck. They asked me what I would have done if they had not picked me up, and when I said I would have walked, I believe they thought me mad. But this is the sanest thing I ever did. I must tell you that I am dying. My illness is quite incurable, even if I could afford doctors, and I have only weeks left, perhaps a couple of months. Don't be sad. I have never been happier in my life. I should tell you what I wrote in my kavitlach. I asked God to grant happiness to my daughter Elena. I believe he will. Farewell, your father. The smoked ham was sliced as thin as paper and rolled into dainty cylinders. The bread rolls were home-baked, fresh that morning. There was a glass jar of potato salad made with real mayonnaise and crisp chopped onion. There were a bottle of wine, another bottle of soda, and a bag of oranges, and a packet of cigarettes, his brand. Elena began to pack the food into the picnic basket. She had just closed the lid when she heard the knock at the door. She took off her apron before going to open it. Van Damme stepped inside, closed the door behind him, and kissed her. He put his arms around her and held her painfully tightly. He always did this, and it always hurt. But she never complained, for they had almost lost each other, and now, when they were together, they were just so grateful. They went into the kitchen, Van Damme hefted the picnic basket and said, "Lord, what have you got in here, the crown jewels?"
"What's the news?" Elena asked.
He knew she meant news of the war in the desert. He said, "Axis forces in full retreat," and I quote. She thought how relaxed he was these days. He even talked differently. A little gray was appearing in his hair, and he laughed a lot. "I think you're one of those men who gets more good-looking as he gets older," she said. "Wait till my teeth drop out." They went out. The sky was curiously black, and Elena said, "Oh," in surprise as she stepped into the street. "End of the world today," Van Damme said.
"I've never seen it like this before," Elena said.
They got on the motorcycle and headed for Billy's school. The sky became even darker. The first rain fell as they were passing Shepherd's Hotel. Elena saw an Egyptian drape a handkerchief over his fez. The raindrops were enormous. Each one soaked right through her dress to the skin. Van Damme turned the bike around and parked in front of the hotel. As they dismounted, the clouds burst. They stood under the hotel canopy and watched the storm. The sheer quantity of water was incredible. Within minutes, the gutters overflowed and the pavements were awash. Opposite the hotel, the shopkeepers waded through the flood to put up shutters. The cars simply had to stop where they were. "There's no main drainage in this town," Van Damme remarked. "The water has nowhere to go but the Nile. Look at it." The street had turned into a river.
"What about the bike?" Elena said.
"Damn thing will float away," said Van Damme. "I'll have to bring it under here." He hesitated, then dashed out onto the pavement, seized the bike by its handlebars, and pushed it through the water to the steps of the hotel. When he regained the shelter of the canopy, his clothes were thoroughly soaked, and his hair was plastered around his head like a mop coming out of a bucket. Elena laughed at him. The rain went on a long time. Elena said, "What about Billy?"
"They'll have to keep the kids at school until the rain stops."
Eventually, they went into the hotel for a drink. Van Damme ordered sherry. He had sworn off gin and claimed he did not miss it. At last, the storm ended, and they went out again. But they had